One thing I really appreciate about the feast is that there's music every day. We don't have that luxury a lot of times in our smaller congregations, but it's lovely that we've got that talent in the church and they're able to share it. So thank you very much for that beautiful piece. So we all would have the ability to identify what we would consider to be our quote-unquote favorite feasts. This is actually my 47th Feast of Tabernacles. My dad started attending the church in 1976, right after the feast. And so our first Feast of Tabernacles was in 1977. And being from the Midwest, I think I attended Wisconsin Dells probably 12 or 13 years in a row. And I have certain memories of Wisconsin Dells, of course, but nothing that really sort of stands out that I would identify something like that as my favorite feast. Let's be honest, when we ask about our favorite feasts, what we're really asking are two different things. First, you know, was there something that was done or said on a spiritual level that just was really memorable? Right? Maybe there was a particular message, or maybe there was a theme that just resonated with us during that particular feast. Maybe there was something going on personally in your life that feast just was enhanced because of that. We have those, of course. Second, though, when you think about your favorite feast, a lot of times you will go back to the physical aspect of it. And that's okay. That's completely acceptable because we're told and instructed and commanded to rejoice, right? And so that's all right. Maybe it was the location that really stood out to you. You know, one of my favorites is our family had the blessing of being able to attend in Italy back in 2014. And I'm kind of a little bit of an old building, ruins, kind of a junkie. And so going to some place like Italy was, you know, to me was just absolutely phenomenal. But I also loved that the fact that the brethren, it was a smaller feast site, and the brethren all were in one place, and we ate all the meals together, and it just gave the opportunity for us to really form some stronger relationships, something that I wasn't exposed to previously. And so that one really resonated with me. The other one that stands out with me, though, was in 30-plus years ago, in 1990. This is right after I started my senior year in high school. We were attending in Acapulco, Mexico, just me and my parents. I did have one friend from a sister church, but other than that, I didn't know anybody when I was there. And the feast really stands out as one of my most memorable, primarily because of some very specific moments that occurred there and how those moments affected me and what I learned from those particular moments. I learned that not every restaurant has cheeseburgers. There was one evening where we went to what I can only assume at that time was probably a nicer restaurant. It was up on the hill. It was looking down on the bay. And I didn't recognize anything on the menu, even though it was all in English. I still didn't recognize anything. And so when the waiter came up and wanted to take our order, I asked for hamburguesa con queso. I was learning Spanish in high school at that time, so I was practicing it, which is a hamburger with cheese. I wanted a cheeseburger. And he did not crack the slightest smile at that request. He looked at me, and he looked at my parents, and he looked back at me, and in a very insulted tone said, "Does this look like McDonald's?" So after consulting with my parents, I had to settle for beef Wellington. Closest thing I could find to a hamburguesa con queso, I guess. I learned about racism at that feast. Many of the Mexican brethren there could barely afford to make it to the feast. They were scraping by, not only on whatever second tie they had, but they had to typically throw more at it just to get there, just to be able to attend the feast. Most of them stayed off of the main strip, right, in less expensive subpar hotels. We were in a high-rise on the bay of Acapulco. The festival coordinator made an announcement to those who might be attending from other countries, primarily, obviously, the United States, mentioning about the financial hardship of not all, but many of the Mexican brethren there. And he said that there would be a sign-up list and that the families would sign up. And if you were so inclined and if you did have the ability, maybe take them out for a meal. And so we signed up and we were connected with a family. There was a single mother. There was a son in his late 20s. His name was Ronaldo. He's the only one whose name I remember. There was a teenage daughter, and then there was a family friend who was in her early 20s. The only one who could speak English was Ronaldo. and it was broken English at best. And even with that language issue, our families could not have hit it off better during that time. We spent every remaining moment with them for that feast. And near the end of the feast, my dad invited them back to our hotel for lunch and to go swimming in the pool. And as we're all swimming, a hotel employee came up to the son and said something to him, and suddenly all of our Mexican friends are getting out of the pool. And so my dad goes and asks Ronaldo, what's going on? And he said that the hotel policy is that Mexicans were not allowed in the pool, and they would get up and they'd have to leave. My dad was irate, furious at what he was witnessing here. Manager comes over. The manager would not budge on this particular topic. Now, Ronaldo and the family were just so humble, so understanding of this. You know, they calmed my dad down. They convinced him that it's okay. You know, that's all right. And so we decided that we were going to head up to the room and we would just continue our fellowship there. And then they were stopped again because, you see, Mexicans were not allowed to walk through the lobby. And so what they would have to do is they would have to go out to the beach and they would have to walk a half mile down, and then they could walk a half mile back to the hotel, and then they were told they would be allowed to come into a side entrance of the hotel. It was hard to watch. It's really hard to watch. And then finally, there was a rather simple thing that I saw, but for whatever reason, it really stuck out to me. And it was while we were shopping in one of the markets, my parents were off there haggling for some cheap touristy knickknacks, and I see this little girl, she's maybe 5 or 6 years old, and she's sitting alone, and she's playing with this toy car on the sidewalk, and she's just as happy as can be. But as she's playing with the toy, suddenly it breaks, and she starts bawling. She's just crying. She's devastated by this. And suddenly there's an American tourist who stops by, and he sees this, and he bends down, and he asks her what's wrong. She doesn't speak English. You know, she's just showing him this broken car in her hand. And so he takes the car, and he fiddles with it, and he's trying to get it, you know, put back together for her, and it's just, he can't. The car's broken. And so he reaches into his pocket, and he pulls out some change, and he gives her the change, and he goes on. And as he walks away, I then see her pick up her car, and she quickly puts it back together, and she starts playing with it again until the next person came along. She got three American citizens to give her money this way. That stood out with me. Now, we live in a world that, for all intents and purposes, is broken. Now, not everything is broken in this world, of course. There is still good in this world, but I think when you look at it holistically, and you look at it from a big picture, you look at where things are heading, I think it's safe to say that things aren't getting better. Things aren't improving. And when you look at it, it's at every level, whether it's societal, whether it's governmental, as Mr. Reynoso mentioned, whether it's familial. So why can't this be fixed? Why can't it be fixed? Well, just like that little toy car that girl was playing with, we have the wrong people trying to fix it. So let's start with the macro level. When we look at this world from a societal standpoint overall, it's broken. There are truly some very, very sad situations that span this entire globe. Earlier this year, my wife and I went and saw the movie called Sound of Freedom, which is based on a true story. It's about the search, the rescue of minors who were taken, abducted into modern slavery, or in this particular case, it was sexual exploitation. Now, it obviously was not a 100% accurate story, but if anybody can name to me a Hollywood movie that's based on a true story that's 100% accurate, I'd be very interested to talk to you after services. But so it's not completely, but it does call to the fact that modern slavery, human trafficking, is a real issue. It's a big issue in society, and for whatever reason, society mostly turns a blind eye to it. We don't hear about it very often. David Malloy on the BBC.com website referenced a report that was published by the UN in September of 2022. And quoting the report, he writes this: "The International Labor Organization, or the ILO, estimates suggest that 50 million people, or one out of every 150 people alive, are trapped in forced labor or forced marriages. That's up nearly 10 million on its numbers from just 5 years ago. About 27.6 million people are in forced labor, including 3.3 million children. Of those children, more than half are in commercial sexual exploitation. Another 22 people are in forced marriages, more than two-thirds of them women, many victims under the age of 15 when the marriage takes place. And he quotes Guy Ryder, who's the general director of the ILO, who says, "Nothing can justify the persistence of this fundamental abuse of human rights." So how does our society accept this? How is this not a bigger priority around the world? Just that one topic. Because society's broken. Paul writes about this, comparing the righteousness of God to man. We can read this in Romans chapter 3. Romans chapter 3, and we'll start in verse 9. "What then? Are we better than they? Not at all. For we have previously charged both Jews and Greeks that they are all under sin. As it is written, there is none righteous, no, not one. There is none who understands. There is none who seeks after God. They have all turned aside. They have together become unprofitable. There is none who does good, no, not one. Their throat is an open tomb. With their tongues they have practiced deceit. The poison of asps is under their lips, whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their ways, and the way of peace they have not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes." And that's part of the problem right there. That's part of the reason why society is broken. There is no fear of God before their eyes. And what do we read, not just once, but a few times in Proverbs? What does it tell us the fear of the Lord is? It is the beginning of wisdom. Society lacks godly wisdom. The wisdom itself comes from another source. It goes all the way back to the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And no matter how hard man tries, he will not be able to fix the issues that plague society today. Even just the one that we were talking about. Whether that's slavery, whether it's poverty, whether it's starvation, whether it's racism, whether it's hatred. Last year in the United States alone, 100,000 people died of overdoses. 50,000 people died from suicide. Why is this not getting better? Why is it getting worse? It's because we have the wrong people trying to fix it. Let's go get down one level. Let's consider the world's governments. How genuinely are they doing at fixing the challenges that faces their own citizens? How are they doing? How about our little country here? Right? We'll talk about just this little experiment that we call the United States. How do we say our government is working? Well, according to Statista.com, so far the September approval ratings for Congress stand at 19%. 78% are disapproving. The latest Quinnipiac poll has the president's approval at 37%, with 57% disapproving. And this is supposed to be the greatest country on earth. Now, relatively speaking, compared to others, this is a great country. We're extremely blessed to live here. You recently had a coup in Niger. Yes, that is the proper way to pronounce it. I looked it up because I wasn't 100% sure. But some might say Niger. It's Niger. Yeah, there you have a democratically elected president where you just had a military coup occur. Other countries have fallen that way. You have dictatorships. You have North Korea. You've got Putin in Russia, right? They're all very oppressive to their people. You have countries where the citizens desperately need things like medicine and food, yet because of the corruption, they never get what is sent to them, those who desperately need it. Isaiah chapter 3. Isaiah 3 and verse 1. I'm going to read this from the New Living Translation. Verse 1, the Lord of heaven's armies will take away from Jerusalem and Judah everything that they depend on, every bit of bread, every drop of water, all their heroes, soldiers, judges, prophets, fortune tellers, and elders, army officers, high officials, advisors, skilled craftsmen, astrologers. I will make boys their leaders, toddlers their rulers. People will oppress each other, man against man, neighbor against neighbor. Young people will insult their elders. Vulgar people will sneer at the honorable. In those days, a man will say to his brother, since you have a coat, you be our leader. Take charge of this heap of ruins. But he will reply, no, I can't. I don't have extra food or clothes. Don't put me in charge. For Jerusalem will stumble, Judah will fall, because they speak out against the Lord and refuse to obey him. They provoke him to his face. This could be a description of many, many of the governments that are run by man, that were created by man. There's a quote from Winston Churchill that's very famous. It says that democracy is the worst form of government, except for all the others. But even with that, is that working? Why can't man create a government that just works? That it works in a way that it's just, and that it's fair, that it takes everything into account. What is the best that the citizens need, for example? Why? It's because we have the wrong people trying to fix this. Let's take it down one additional level. What about the family? Is the family unit functioning as God had intended it, as God had designed it? Is it serving the purpose in which it was meant to be? You know, is it creating godly offspring, as Malachi 2 says, that God desires from it? Now, I know that we have burned into our brains the statistics about failed marriages, that 50% of all marriages end in divorce. That's not actually accurate. There's a lot of factors that go into that. It's actually about 1 in 4 for the first marriage. So if you're in a first marriage, you've got a 75% chance of success. Where it really starts to fall apart, though, is when you're talking about multiple marriages. In those cases, 75% of second, third, fourth marriages end in divorce. God hates divorce. Do you want to know the country that has the most children living in single-parent homes? The United States. 25% of children live in single-parent homes. There was over 600,000 children abused last year. 2,000 of those children died because of that abuse. The last year of abortion data for the U.S. was 2019. With the CDC, there were 630 abortions that were reported in the United States. The World Health Organization, their models estimate that that's not right. It was probably closer to 890,000 in 2019 in the United States. But do you want to know what the World Health Organization reports the number of abortions that occur annually on average globally? 73 million. 73 million. The family unit, as God has intended, has been absolutely devastated by continuous attacks. Satan knows how important family is to the plan of God, and so he's going on to the offensive. There's a very well-known activist organization whose primary message, based upon everything that was occurring in the past few years, was extremely, extremely important. But then they also had additional objectives and goals. And on their website, they had one goal in which they say the purpose of this was to dismantle the patriarchal practice. And the goal says, we disrupt the Western prescribed nuclear family structure requirement by supporting each other as extended families and villages that collectively care for one another, especially our children, to the degree that mothers, parents, and children are comfortable. What's missing from that goal? Fathers. Again, the goal of that was to dismantle the patriarchal practice. This society doesn't need less fathers. It needs more fathers. You see an increase in aggression from this radical LGBTQ agenda that exists, who want to redefine the very definition of what family is. You know, no longer is a man a man. No longer is a woman a woman. God's plan, when he created them male and female, which is backed by science, that's thrown out the window. They don't want that anymore. Let's take a look at Jeremiah chapter 32. Jeremiah 32 and verse 32. Because of all the evil of the children of Israel and the children of Judah, which they have done to provoke me to anger, they, their kings, their princes, their priests, their prophet, the men of Judah, and the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And they have turned to me the back and not the face, though I taught them, rising up early, teaching them, yet they have not listened to receive instruction. But they set their abominations in the house which is called by my name to defile it. And they built the high places of Baal, which are in the valley and the son of Hinnom, to cause their sons and their daughters to pass through the fire to Molech, which I did not command them, nor did it come into my mind that they should do this abomination to cause Judah to sin. Child sacrifice. Parents today may not be sacrificing their children to the fire of Molech, but they are sacrificing their children at the altar of inclusivity, acceptance, political correctness. Christ said in Matthew 18:6, whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and he were drowned in the depth of the sea. Why is this not being fixed? Why does this only seem to be getting worse? It's because we have the wrong people trying to fix it. Okay, can we go down any further from that? We talked about society, we talked about government, we talked about family. How about you? How about me? Are we broken? If the goal and the target are the perfection of God in heaven, then yes, I'm broken. And if the goal is to be holy as God is holy, then yes, I'm broken. And the problem with that is that we have the wrong people trying to fix it. Isaiah chapter 64. Isaiah 64 and verse 1. Oh, that you would rend the heavens, that you would come down, that the mountains might shake at your presence as fire burns brushwood, as fire causes water to boil, to make your name known to your adversaries, that the nations may tremble at your presence. When you did awesome things for which we did not look, you came down, the mountains shook at your presence. For since the beginning of the world, men have not heard nor perceived by ear, nor has the eye seen any God besides you, who acts for the one who waits for him. You meet him who rejoices and does righteousness, who remembers you in your ways. You're indeed angry, for we have sinned. In these ways we continue, and we need to be saved. But we are all like an unclean thing. All of our unrighteousnesses are like filthy rags. We fade as a leaf, and our iniquities, like the wind, have taken us away. This is us. This is you. This is me, like filthy rags. And no matter how hard we try to clean those rags, they simply won't come clean. Paul said in 1 Timothy 1:15, this is a faithful saying and worthy of all acceptance, that Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, of whom I am chief. Have we gotten to that point yet in our lives? In order to begin fixing something, you have to first recognize that it's broken. It needs to be fixed. And as first fruits, we were shown that we were broken and that we desperately needed the atoning sacrifice of Jesus Christ. We learned exactly what we were compared to God and to his Son. Mark chapter 2. Mark 2 and verse 15. Now it happened as he was dining in Levi's house that many tax collectors and sinners also sat together with Jesus and his disciples. For there were many, and they followed him. And when the scribes and Pharisees saw him eating with the tax collectors and sinners, they said to his disciples, How is it that he eats and drinks with tax collectors and sinners? And when Jesus heard it, he said to them, those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I did not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. Tim Keller, who is a very prominent Calvinist pastor, said, the church is a hospital for sinners, not a museum for saints. So to begin being fixed, we had to recognize that we were and that we are sinners. And then the process can begin, the fixing process. But what exactly was it about us that was broken? What exactly is it about man that is broken? There are some very, very nice and good atheists in the world. They're moral people, serving people, they're very loving people. Some of them are better than others who profess themselves to be Christians, as a matter of fact. So then what is exactly broken? We'll go a few chapters ahead to Mark chapter 7. Mark chapter 7 and verse 14. When he had called all the multitude to himself, he said to them, hear me, everyone, and understand. There is nothing that enters a man from outside which can defile him, but the things which come out of him, those are the things that defile a man. If anyone has ears to hear, let him hear. And when he had entered a house away from the crowd, his disciples asked him concerning the parable. So he said to them, are you thus without understanding also? Do you not perceive that whatever enters a man from outside cannot defile him, because it does not enter his heart, but his stomach, and is eliminated, thus purifying all foods? And he said, what comes out of a man, that defiles a man. For from within, out of the heart of men, proceed evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications, murders, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lewdness, an evil eye, blasphemy, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within and defile a man. And there we have the root cause. There we have the primary problem. When I first got into a sales career 25 years ago or so, I used to sell quality management software to healthcare systems. And part of that software had a module which could do what was called a root cause analysis. So in other words, if you're in a hospital, and let's say you're there to get your left arm amputated, and they accidentally cut off your right arm, which happens way more often than you think, we need to know why. Right, so this module will help them backtrack and figure out what happened. In other words, what was the root cause that caused that particular error? It was summed up in the saying, you keep asking why until you can't ask why anymore. That's how you would perform one. The root cause of our individual brokenness is our heart. The root cause of the breakdown of family as God designed it is man's heart. The breakdown and failure of the world's government is man's heart. And the society that we have around us is crumbling, is caused by man's broken heart. And this is nothing new. This goes back to the times of Noah. In fact, we can look at that in Genesis chapter 6. Genesis 6 and verse 5. Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. So the Lord said, I will destroy whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping things and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them. The evil that was in man's heart at that time, it was so intense, it was so fierce, that God was sorry that he had made man. Now, he was not giving up on his plan. His plan for mankind was firm. That was never in question here. But he was sorrowful, and there needed to be a reset at this point. And here we are now. We are at the Feast of Tabernacles. We are celebrating the millennial rule of Jesus Christ and his saints. And to begin to bring about the time of the restoration of all things, we have to understand the root cause. Now, Satan, of course, is going to be bound. We understand that. But the issue of man's heart still has to be addressed, still has to be fixed. But just because it's broken, just like that little car, doesn't mean that it can't be fixed. It's interesting that when Paul in Acts 13 identifies David as a man after God's own, what? He's a man after God's own heart. Why is he identified that way? Well, let's take a look at that. You start turning to Psalm 51. It's a very well-known psalm. This is written by David. This is after Nathan the prophet had to have a little talk with David about the situation with Bathsheba. But Psalm 51 in verse 1, "Have mercy upon me, O God, according to your loving kindness, according to the multitude of your tender mercies." That right there is just an amazing description of God and his faithfulness and his mercy and his grace. "Blot out my transgressions. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity. Cleanse me from my sin.